Friends, I waited in the fountain, just south of the administration building, and gently stroked the catfish that once swam there among the water lilies. And later at Dixon Junior High, and especially Provo High School, I remember resenting BYU for the attention and support it received from city and citizens. But one of my most vivid memories is at the age of 13, walking for the first time from floor to floor through the J. Reuben Clark Library, now the Harold Bealey Library. It was a jarring and ultimately humbling experience. I'd never seen so many books in one place before, never actually appreciated that so many books existed. In one stunning, memorable afternoon, the way I viewed my sheltered world changed dramatically and forever, and I painfully realized just how relatively small and insignificant I really was. 5 years later, as a first semester undergraduate at BYU, I was sitting in Marvin Hill's Survey American History class when a middle-aged woman proudly, almost defiantly, announced to the 20 or so member class that when she'd years earlier converted to Mormonism, she'd handed David O. McKay her free agency as a gift. It seemed obvious to me that Professor Hill disagreed fundamentally with her, but he responded in such a way that made this 18-year-old understand he respected her views and valued her opinions. The next semester, Hiram Andrus, shortly before he was forbidden to teach, led an upper-level class in weekly forays into the mysteries of the Pearl of Great Price. Never before had the church, its doctrines and scriptures, been so stimulating. Leon Hartshorne, Ivan J. Barrett, and Larry Porter followed in subsequent semesters. I'll never forget Lamar Barrett's sage advice in one class: beware of brethren in business. In another, Susan Black, the wise first female religion instructor, asked us students to write an essay on whether we would have remained in the church or have left it had we been living as Mormons in Missouri in the late 1830s. My answer was, I would have left the church. Sister Black made no attempt to talk me out of my response, and I earned an A on the assignment. Later, John Sorensen engaged us students in spirited critiques of contemporary Mormonism. Leonard Arrington raised our understanding of Mormon history to new, exciting levels. Hal Miller, Donovan Fleming, and Gary Bunker shared their insights and questions regarding the church and psychology. Michael Quinn set high standards of courage and conviction.
It has been the need for vocal, loving criticism. And I think that bishops, stake presidents, general authorities, the administration of BYU, the alumni association of BYU, BYU Today should hear of your views if you don't like what's going on, or even if you do.
I'd like to take the time now just to thank the panelists, Sam Taylor, his daughter Sarah, Carl, April, Kate, and BJ. Thanks. Them as among the most intellectually stimulating and rewarding of my life. Thus, I have recently found myself both angered beyond words and saddened to the very bottom of my soul at the anti-intellectual stranglehold that has taken grip of the university. Angered because of the relentless arrogance of the assault, saddened because of the tragic loss of something I once cherished, and feeling helpless to reverse it. Earlier this year, sitting in one of the conference rooms at the Seven Peaks Resort Hotel in downtown Provo, I listened to BYU students voice their pain and frustration at the university's hypocritical treatment of faculty they admired. I looked periodically around the room at their faces and felt, I'm embarrassed to say, sorrow for them, that at their relatively young age, they were finding themselves having to confront the lies and misdeeds of their elders. I weep for students like Brian Waterman, who have probably experienced more blatant religious abuse, cleverly disguised as concern, in the past year than most of us here today have in our lifetimes. No one should ever have to choose between their love of the church and their love of the intellect. No one should ever be punished for choosing to follow their conscience. No one should ever be asked or expected to obey stupidity. This morning I'm pleased to introduce the following panel members. Sam Taylor, who attended BYU in the 1920s, and who will be joined by his daughter Sarah. Carl Sandburg, classes of 1954 and 57. April Perry, class of 1974. Kate Call, class of 1974. And B.J. Fogg, classes of 1990 and 1992. Each panelist will have a maximum of approximately 15 minutes. The remaining time at the end will be turned over to the audience and to panelists for questions and answers.
When I was at BYU, Professor M. Wilford Polson was the entire psychology department, and he had an open period at 10 o'clock, and he would walk from the lower campus downtown to a cafe for a cup of postum to avoid the appearance of evil. The waitress would put the postum can next to his cup. This went on for several years, and one day there was a different waitress. He ordered postum. She gave him postum. He was so furious, he never came back. According to a temporary eye condition, my daughter will read my paper. Sarah Weston.
Good morning. Oh my, at the Y. Reed Smoot had become a U.S. senator, but the Y wasn't a university when I began kindergarten at Brigham Young Academy with Ida Dusenberry as my teacher. Ida Smoot Dusenberry was a younger sister of Reed Smoot. I wasn't too fond of kindergarten because each day Miss Dusenberry would tie me up with a rope and lock me in a black closet. While I never complained, the curriculum did seem monotonous. Each day when my mother asked what I'd learned, I would say truthfully to take little bites. During the course of the year, this was all there was time for outside the closet. Being of modest nature, I never told my mother that I was receiving special attention. She was baffled when I refused to continue my education at BYA, but she enrolled me in the first grade at the Parker School, where my teacher was Edith Young, granddaughter of Brigham. During my college days at BYU, there were 1,500 students, and we were haunted by the rumor that the church was going to close it down. I belonged to a literary group of faculty members and students. Among students were Jean Paulson, editor of the student paper, on the verge of a distinguished career in journalism. Max Taylor, no relation, became an editor of a major publishing house, and he gave me the secret of writing a bestseller. Put "how to" in the title. Virginia Egertson became the successful author Virginia Sorensen. Carlton Kalmsey received recognition as a university history professor. I was a brash know-it-all who had begun publishing in national magazines. Glenn Potter and T. Hedig had great promise, but both died young. Faculty members included Lowry Nelson, who later left the Y, after narrowly escaping excommunication because of a single word spoken in casual conversation with a visiting fanatic. At the University of Minnesota, he published in May 1952 the first article in a national magazine calling attention to the LDS policy of discrimination against blacks. Other faculty members included M. Wilford Paulson, who was secretly collecting his monumental library on early Mormonism. A.C. Lambert was mining the same vein, secretly writing material pertaining to the obscure, arcane, controversial, suppressed, or sensitive aspects of LDS history and doctrine. Both Lambert and Paulson got into serious trouble because of their research. AC's secret quest was discovered, and it cost him his position on the faculty. When Paulson published evidence that the Word of Wisdom reflected popular sentiment at the time Joseph gave it to the saints, a local zealot attempted to have him sacked at the Y and tried for his church membership. Other faculty members included Gentle Elsie C. Carroll, author and patron of the arts, who annually awarded a gold medal for the best Christmas story. And my search for the winner one year, Gay Dimmick, ultimately resulted in marriage. Harrison R. Merrill, who later became editor of the Improvement Era, vied with Alfred Osmond for the title of Poet Lariat, spelled L-A-R-I-A-T, each contributing voluminous doggerel verse to the Provo Herald. In my opinion, this was the very best writing of both men, and it was the only acceptable humor concerning the local culture. During my senior year at the Y, I became night clerk at the Roberts Hotel, and at my first day on the job, I found my kindergarten teacher, Ida Dusenberry, sitting in the lobby. Our eyes met and locked with recognition. She had lived for many years at the Roberts in a small room which rented for $5 a week. A few days later, she checked out and I never saw her again. Had my presence driven her away? While gaining a liberal education at the Y, I received a liberal course in human nature at the hotel. Even among the fairest flowers of Zion, I discovered, love would find a way, generally via the back stairs. The noble experiment of prohibition had made drinking fashionable, while the bootlegger was a quasi-respectable figure. As night clerk, I discovered that several BYU students were working their way through school as bootleggers, which was a newsworthy enough item to mention in a column I wrote for the student paper. The ink was hardly dry on the Y News when I was on the carpet. When I refused to name them, I was suspended. When back in school, the next column picked off the scab, and I was out again. The pattern repeated itself until after the sixth suspension, I had been tied in the closet once too often. I dropped out. After all, I can take a hint. Thank you.
Someone in a sally of humor suggested turning BYU into a 50s theme park. I thought instead of Rip Van Sandberg going to sleep on the Mazur lawn one Sunday afternoon and waking up some 40 years later and looking for the campus. And this actually happened, as I've had the experience of going back to BYU as a visiting professor on two occasions, first in 1982 and most recently in this past winter semester. Each time marked by the most pleasant and cordial relationship with students, colleagues, and administration. But what was BYU in the 1950s? We'd have to see all of the administrative offices in the Mazur building, with registration being carried out in the gym or the field house. The Heber J. Grant building was the library. Sciences were taught in the richly odoriferous Brimhall building, and overflow classes were held in the north building, a set of three overheated Quonset huts. The Eyring Science Center was just being built. We made the trek between the upper and the lower campuses fall, winter, and spring. Dormitories and married student housing were surplus army barracks. Mat dances were held in the social hall twice a week. The lower campus has now fallen into ruin, and what used to be the upper campus is now merely a remote corner of the only campus. But the social and the intellectual center of the campus at that time for the 5,000 or so students then enrolled was the Joseph Smith Building, with its light brick and white cast stone and dynamic lines rising up to the mountains. People ate in the cafeteria in its basement, attended English and religion classes in its classrooms, went to church, assemblies, devotionals, and concerts in its auditorium, and danced in its ballroom. The Joseph Smith Building, the intellectual center? Oh, yes. This is where Hubie Brown had his office as part of the religion department. He taught 400 or 500 students per quarter, and they heard an expansive view of Mormonism. The test of a religion is the abundance of the life it produces. You don't have to believe anything that isn't true. Another principle of our religion, you would say, is that anything that is true is part of your religion as soon as you will reach out and take it. He didn't seem to care so much about anyone's ideas being orthodox or heterodox as he did that people have ideas. If you lay hold on an incorrect idea, you can correct it. But if you don't have any ideas at all, you're stuck in the mud. The Joseph Smith Building was also the office of P.A. Christensen, venerable chair of the English department. People say that students take false doctrines out of my classes, he once told me. But I've been teaching here for 25 years, and I know that 85% of them don't take any doctrines out, true or false. He may have been right about doctrines, but not about ideas. For him and for others in the English department, literature was charged with ideas and with energies that made a difference. I've since taught at 7 different universities and attended 3 others, and I have yet to find teachers who better performed the office of education. That is, in the Platonic sense of drawing out what is already inside the individual. I found no one who has surpassed a number of people that I had as teachers at that time at BYU. Lawrence Sardoni in the music department, I want to mention, who opened up the world of Brahms. Leonard Rice in the English department, James L. Barker. And the 13th article of faith was a favorite theme. And there was an atmosphere of acceptance. I remember Leonard Rice saying one time, "Carl, never tell anyone he's a bad Mormon. He might start to believe you." How should one prepare to go on a mission? Well, again, in the old Joseph Smith building, one might hear Garrett DeYoung tell a group of young people that the best way to prepare for a mission is to learn how to talk with as many different people as you can on their own ground. The world was a rich and not a hostile place, and BYU professors who served as mission presidents urged missionaries to become familiar with art museums, concert halls, and opera houses in the cities where they worked. Also, in the Joseph Smith building were offices of others in the religion department, less charismatic than Hubie Brown, but well-intentioned and competent. And others, be it spoken in candor, were with utter sincerity and devotion anti-intellectual. They did not hesitate to name by name those in various departments around campus whom they considered to be anti-Christ. Korihor was a favorite figure and metaphor. The testimony of the Spirit and the atonement of Christ were the beginning and the end of all questions. The educational enterprise, except as it enabled someone to make a living, was at best worthless and often harmful. An intellectual, one of them said, is someone who has sold the Savior down the river. Yes, it was possible to encounter within one building all of the disparate forces and cross currents of Mormonism. BYU in the early 50s was, in short, beset, even at that time, by the tensions that always accompany learning by study and also by faith, but it was a confident and outward-looking place. Now, this does not mean that many, perhaps most, were not lulled by the lotus land of Provo in the spring. The air was full of "put another nickel in the Nickelodeon, all I want is loving you and music, music, music." Or another ballad of the heart ending with, "and we'll live on love and potato chips, potato chips, potato chips." Oh, I remember it with joy, and with Jeannie, and with Marjorie. As Doc Miller from the econ department used to say, "how can you hold them down on the farm once they've seen Provo?" What has stayed the same? Well, Lotus Land is alive and well. Many students seem to be having an interesting social experience. But so is the diversity and the outreach of the faculty. And students I've had in my classes were not less capable than students I've had anywhere, and were often more earnest about the questions. What has changed? Well, BYU has achieved national status in a number of academic fields. It is, admittedly, number one in foreign language technology, which I would never have supposed while studying French and German there without so much as a tape recorder. And it's an international campus. More languages are taught at BYU than at any other university, and many other disciplines could be cited. What has changed for sure is American society and higher education, which have gone through the Korean War, the Vietnam War, Watergate, recessions, the collapse of the Cold War, and are now experiencing the continual battles of the culture wars. And what seems to me to be the biggest change at BYU during all of the national turmoil is a loss of confidence. An example. When the Honor Code was established in the early 50s, it applied only to academic work and could be stated very simply. The students agreed not to cheat, and the faculty agreed not to snoop. It worked well. Honor could only arise from within. To think of honor as being enforced would have been a contradiction in terms, a loss of confidence in the principle of honor, a loss of confidence in students and in the faculty. An example. One part of the statement of academic freedom at BYU says that, quote, because the gospel encompasses all truth and affirms the full range of human modes of knowing, the scope of integration for LDS scholars is in principle as wide as truth itself, unquote. Which by itself is a statement of confidence. But in practice, academic freedom must be limited, the document says, because if, quote, no restraints on individual academic freedom, if there were no restraints on individual academic freedom, religious universities would converge toward a secular model and lose their distinctive character. I ponder this statement and blink. What is given by one hand is taken away by the other, because it is assumed that the religion of the Latter-day Saint community would lose in an open contest with secular modes. Is this the stone cut out of the mountain without hands that will break into pieces all of the other kingdoms of the world, as our progenitors confidently expected? No, it has lost that force of confidence. The result of this perception seems to be a general obsession within the church with control, and the effect of that control seems to be nothing so much as the ghettoization of Mormon intellectual and social life. The widening gyre of the 50s appears to be changing into a narrowing vortex. And I have to comment on my reaction to a story in the Tribune just this last month, a story defending the tenure decision cases by the Faculty Review Committee. The writer said that he was familiar with the process, had in fact sat as a member of the review committee in previous years, had seen nothing that was not common practice at Stanford and the University of Illinois. He then appended his personal opinion that anyone working to destroy the church shouldn't be there. Well, that filled me with alarm. If people reviewing dossiers do so with the thought in mind that any candidates who do not toe a party line or have a different approach to basic human questions are working to destroy the institution, then what was a small cloud in 1950, no larger than a man's hand, has become a dominant voice. And it filled me with alarm for another reason, because it caused me to believe that Stanford and the University of Illinois are in worse shape than I thought. Will the obsession with control prevail? I don't believe so. There are too many energies loose in society and in the church to be turned back. Many of them are gathered at BYU, as in the net cast into the sea gathering in fish of all kinds. Whatever side people are on, they will see fish that they don't like in the net. But that's all right. That's part of the mix. If it smells fishy sometimes, that's the way it's supposed to be.
When I was about 16, my parents sat me down. We had a little talk about where I was going to go to college. And I still to this day remember I had a scholarship at that time that I could have applied to any university I wanted to use to go to. And there was no question whatsoever that there was only one choice, and they let me know that. My parents were very, very, very Mormon, very controlling. There was just no other option for me, but I was absolutely thrilled just at the thought of leaving home. Because, I mean, I lived in Florida, kind of in a swamp. And I don't know how to explain it. And our little West Gannett Ward Chapel was in a big grove of pine trees. It looked like a Baptist church. It was called West Gannett Branch. And every Sunday we would faithfully go into church, and there was always a big poster right on the side of the foyer when you came in, of this little wood building that said, be honest with yourself. And they would circulate these every couple of months. The church would send these out. And it would always show some scene of someone offering someone a cigarette, and the teenager was going, no, no, you know. And I would always remember that blue banner, be honest with yourself. And that's sort of a sidelight that I'll come back to, but I went to BYU, and when I arrived, it was the first time I'd seen so many Mormons in all my life, and I was just overwhelmed that I had all these friends, and I was back in Zion, the place my parents had always told me that they wanted to return to when they grew old. Even now, it kind of, I don't know why it moved me, but it really moved me. And being the first child of 10 children and being my mother's right-hand person, I really did not have a lot of time in life to ever socialize or have friends. And my parents had 5 or 6 church jobs, and they traveled many miles to church, and we would spend the whole day there. And we'd always have a picnic lunch or a fish fry. I mean, all kinds of things happen out in the mission field to make things work that aren't necessarily church policy. At least in those days, they did. But BYU was a wonderful experience for me because for the first time, I had time. For the first time, I could read books. For the first time, I had $35 a month. And my world expanded. I met people, and my life was changed. They had, in the 60s when I started, the big emphasis then was the dress code. It was the era of the hippies and demonstrations. And men were not supposed to grow their hair long, and all the women had to wear dresses and little shoes, you know, that went with your outfit. I looked at everybody and thought it was really odd. I mean, I probably owned one. Everything I owned fit in one small suitcase that I had in this whole world when I went. And I was amazed at all the shoes the girls had. But I was really deprived. But I was an art major. And in my major, we were always chiseling on rock and throwing pottery, and we had mud all over us. And I soon realized that the dress thing just wasn't going to work. And I started wearing my Levi's to class because it seemed the only reasonable thing to do when you're covered with mud and dust and paint. And I can remember having religion classes. I had 10 minutes to make it from the fine arts building to the religion building. And I remember Rodney Turner was my teacher. And I would run over there in the tent. I finally gave up trying to change my clothes, because I just couldn't make it, and I was supposed to take roll every day for him. He never really raised his head up. He kept his head on his notes, so he never noticed till the last week of class that I was wearing these mud-covered Levi's. And the last week of class, he raised his head, and he saw me taking roll, and he says, "My dear, you have violated the dress code. Would you please leave the room?" And I left the room, and I'll never forget it. I didn't really feel humiliated. I just realized he didn't understand. He didn't understand what I had to do in life as a student. But wearing Levi's, I think, and wearing pants for women was starting to become more and more common then. And they would do these little checks at the Varsity Theater, the movie theater in the Y Center. And this is very depressing when some man at the door is looking under your coat. I mean, he would grab my coat and kind of look under there to make sure I wasn't wearing pants tucked into my boots. And I remember feeling, this, I don't, you know, it was true. I did have pants under my coat. It was true. It was true. I did wear my nightgowns to 7 o'clock classes with my coat over them. I, you know, there are a lot of things you do to save time and energy. But anyway, my sister also, she was a year behind me. And when she came to BYU, she worked on the standards committee. She was quite a socialite and quite well received. And she was putting together a little book helping people to dress more modestly. And it was a university publication. During this time, however, I don't think her skirts were really that short, but one day when she came down the steps of the Wilkinson Center, Ernest L. Wilkinson was there. And, you know, she's a happy sort, really. he opened his coat and he pulled out a big ruler. And he made her stand there, and he measured her skirt from the middle of her knee, and she didn't pass, and she had to go turn herself into her office where she worked. So, there were lots of amazing, curious things that happened to us in those dress code days. The emphasis in those days was really your appearance. They were trying to control appearance. 20 years later, I had a little. My youngest sister went, and by this time, things had gotten. They had to start concentrating on other issues. Her issue when she came and lived in Heritage Halls was that all of her roommates didn't attend church. As soon as they got away from home, they didn't want to go to church. She was the only one attending church, and evidently, this was quite a problem. And the administration, about a month after she came, made it an absolute rule that you had to attend church. And that was very disconcerting to her, that it wasn't a choice. It was mandatory. And now with the recent things, I think the church wants to control your appearance and your behavior, but now it seems to be getting more concerned about what you think and believe. And I have great concerns about that, because I still remember that poster that the church put out in the West Gannett Ward hanging on the wall that said, "Be honest with yourself." And I still think I've had a great struggle in my life of knowing when to speak out and when to keep my mouth closed. And as I get older, I don't think it's done me or anyone else any good just to be silent and to smile. Now I'm ready to speak out, and now I believe, like the poster said years ago, that the church sent out to those branches, that we should all be honest with exactly who we are and where we are, and not have to fear what will happen to us by being honest. Thank you.
For a long time, I felt that women in the church, including myself, have left too much unsaid. When we've sensed that what we had to say would be met with scorn, debate, or disbelief, we fell rather silent. Until only recently, we haven't said much about what we saw in the way we were treated by the bureaucracy of the church, about unfairness, inconsistencies, oppression. When we did speak out, we tended not toward the broad swipes more common to our male peers, but resorted instead to a sort of scratching away. We measured our words when speaking to those assumed to be above us, speaking diplomatically, politely, assessing their response as we went. As women everywhere, we assumed that sweet talk was our best means to the end, a manipulative tool which in the long run had the most likelihood of leaving us intact against the wrath of our dull-witted oppressors. I used to keep chickens in my backyard. Chickens could be seen by some as dull-witted. They don't sing well, either. A friend was telling me about a parable, I guess it is, in which an eagle was raised as a hen. She never tried to fly or to eat chickens because she didn't know she could or that she would like it. In fact, she was raised to fear what she was. When someone told her she was an eagle, she hardly dared try to fly. She had never been taught. She would have to invent it on her own. So I suppose I'm like that, except that by personal preference, I'd rather be something other than an eagle. I'd like to be a bird, all right, but I'd rather be something less predatory, smaller, more fluffy, and rotund. A warbler. Yeah, a warbler in the coop. First of all, as a female, I want to talk about them. They don't understand us. We threaten them. They fear we might accuse them or catch them in weakness or show them up. They want us to silently assume responsibility without taking the credit. They want us to pay our tithing but not say how it gets to be spent, something which I had always heard was called taxation without representation. They want us to minister in myriad ways, so long as those ways remain outside of the officially designated ministering. They don't want us to speak publicly or privately. In fact, I'm increasingly getting the impression they would silence our thoughts if they could. We are, one by one, becoming frightfully uncontrollable, but that doesn't stop them from trying to control. Look at this. There are 25 male department chairs for every female chair at BYU. Feminists are considered by Packer to be part of the triple threat to the church. One up, one down, parent child, keep the secret or be punished, love it or leave it, Pulitzer Prize laurel. Rather than counter an opposing view by using logic and reason, spokesmen for the church or its school resort to personal attack, discrediting the speaker, speaking louder, using the color of their office or status to infer that the other's voice is not worth hearing. So we hear that Cecilia Farr is not a good teacher, not a scholar, not a good citizen of BYU. Her vocalized political leanings were not an issue. Rather than take responsibility for a stance which would paint them as intolerant, they discredit their opponent. Another example, Deborah Lake recently wrote a best-selling and oddly riveting narrative about what it was like growing up female in the male-dominated Mormon church. She went on the Larry King show with another woman, Karen Christ, a local social worker and one of the co-founders of Mormon Women's Forum. They faced off against the church's officially designated spokesperson for the event, Barbara Campbell, of ERA and Sonia Johnson fame. Ms. Campbell's form of debate consisted of personal attack. Rather than address the issues, she informed the listening audience that Karen, who had quoted a statistic about Mormon women and depression, had not been a social worker for very long, and that Mormon Women's Forum only had about 350 members compared to the millions of Mormons worldwide, and the church was growing fast, she might add. She insisted that Deborah Lake just misunderstood church doctrine and suffered from low self-esteem. I had an art professor in my major at BYU. He told me there had never been, and never would be, any great women artists. I wondered if he thought I shouldn't bother to try. Between us gals, let's talk about checks and balances, of which there seem to be few in the church. We claim to have an inside track on the Constitution. We even posthumously happen to meet, baptize, and do temple work for a few of its framers. We say it was written by the guidance of God. We believe we will save it in the last days when it is hanging by a thread. So how do we apply its principles? As a church, we pursue and practice our right not to use the principles of the Constitution or Bill of Rights in our own system of governance. So variously, the church and BYU are within their rights when they control the dissemination of knowledge by extortion and coercion, require church attendance, deny blacks and women the priesthood, condemn people who love someone the church disapproves of, spy on their own members, require confession and then violate confidentiality, destroy personal and professional reputations, exact blind obedience while officially condemning it, tell us how to pray and to whom, all in the name of God and under the protection of law. Sorry, guys, that just doesn't cut it. It may be within your rights, but that doesn't make it right. Now we want to talk about us. Here's a quote about black civil rights. Quote, if you find yourself socialized in white supremacist society, It means that you have internalized self-hatred. Your mind, your body, your soul have been colonized. And if you have not been converted, I mean decolonized, then you are not ready for serious struggle. Conversion is fundamental for any colonized people, any oppressed people who've been told they're less than human. Unquote. I've been thinking about colonization for a solid month, ever since I read that quote. As a Mormon woman, I'll be darned if I don't feel like I've been colonized. Somewhere along the line, I've internalized the oppressor's low opinion of me. That's what's so hard to rise above. I suppose the first generation of a colonized people go either ignorantly or unwillingly into colonization. But the horrible truth is that once they have been socialized to accept the values of the colonizing culture, they defend the assumptions and rules that keep them oppressed. Look at some examples. I've seen a couple of instances where BYU students turn into moral police. In my day at the Y, a great many fine art books had to be kept in a secured section of the library, not because they were expensive or rare, but because a number of students would take their X-Acto knives to any representation of female breasts and genitalia, male or female, in a painting. I don't think it was so they could take it home and use it as a pinup, because they would sometimes take great care to excise the tiniest of organs, not at all worth nailing to a wall. This summer, the editor of BYU Today took it upon himself to postpone an article on cartoonist Steve Benson because he assumed Steve's comments about his grandfather's condition made him a controversial subject for a church-sponsored publication. And, for some bizarre reason, some of the staunchest defenders of women not being able to lay their hands in healing upon their own children's heads are women. In conclusion, a quote from Pauline Bart, a former women's studies professor at University of Chicago who conducts workshops on the effects of rape on women. Quote, "It is significant that research shows that it is not by reasoning with men that women decrease their chance of being raped. It is by yelling, fighting back, and fleeing. No group in power gives up its privilege because of persuasion." We probably won't affect change on the system just by talking about it, but we can change ourselves. We can speak, especially to ourselves. It can't be all that bad learning how to warble.
Hi, everybody. I'm BJ. I'm the last one on the panel. I guess I'm supposed to bring us up to date on this. Let me give you a little bit of my background. I arrived at BYU in the early 80s, much to the amazement of some of my friends. And I'm leaving, actually, this week. I just went to U-Haul, bought the boxes, and I'm loading up. And quite frankly, hopefully never to return to Provo on a permanent basis. I haven't always felt that strongly against BYU, but one of my disclaimers I have listed here, I think on my comments, show the marks of exhaustion. In yesterday's excellent session, Joanna Brooks mentioned exhaustion as one of the factors of activists at BYU, and it's taken its toll. And so these remarks are probably much more pessimistic than I would have been, say, a couple of years ago. Other disclaimers. It's my perspective. It's a student's perspective. And it's one of a person who changed over more or less a decade my coming and goings with BYU. And so my view on things, I mean, it's not a constant, so it's hard to say some of my observations, whether they're truly accurate or whether they've been tainted by my own changing attitudes. I'm going to comment on five kind of relational issues, and let me just outline it for you here. I'm going to look at students and students, students and faculty, students and administration, students and religion, or the LDS Church, and students and ideas, and talk about how I think things were in the early 80s and how things have progressed in each of those five categories. Students in the 80s and students now. When I arrived at BYU, I was really quite impressed with how bright my fellow students were. But I have to be honest, I'm even more impressed with the incoming students now. I think you've all read or heard about the caliber of students that are coming in. You've probably heard about the enrollment ceiling at BYU, which means that BYU can pick and choose, and better students are coming to BYU. I taught freshman English a couple of years ago. I found that my students were exceptionally bright, amazingly bright. The students in regular English would have been the students in honors English when I came to BYU in the early 80s. but they didn't have any real content to work with. They had these skills, they had this raw ability, but they had no content, which made it especially fun for me as a freshman English teacher to present them with content and watch them do things with it. It was very exciting. Another demographic factor that I think you need to consider is that students in general are marrying later at BYU, following the national trend, and that women are much more inclined to finish their degrees, whether they're married or not. And as I understand, that's different than it used to be a few decades ago. In terms of social life at BYU, when I arrived in the early 80s, I found a real strong sense of there was a real social community that was centered around the campus. Student government was very hip. People were very involved. There was a social office. They planned a lot of dances. A lot of things went on. Nowadays, things have really changed, and I think incoming students have no sense of what it was, say, 10 years ago or in the early 80s. Besides homecoming and preference, as far as I know, there are no campus dances. There's not something you just go do on a Friday night. There are virtually no campus activities except for Friday Night Live. I'm talking about currently. The only campus activities that pull students together are football games and monthly devotionals with general authorities. That's really the only sense of campus community that exists today at BYU, I believe. But in the mid and early 80s, I really felt it was different. Clubs, the quasi-Greek system they had going at BYU, was popular and very active, and now it is very struggling. One social unit that was very popular, Sam Hall Society, had like 3 people at their spring retreat last spring. You know, so everything's pretty much, and they've been kind of booted off campus, so that kind of contributes to it. And it's also, I think, it's the nature of the students that are coming to school. They're much more serious about school, and they're not there so much to just have a good time. We've had no concerts. I mean, Billy Joel, Elton John came, cool people came. We've had no concerts for maybe 5 years. And incoming students have no sense of, there was once a time we would go to the Marriott Center and hear Billy Joel sing. Nothing like that. That's students and students' social life. I guess maybe the biggest point I want to make there is what's happened is I think we've lost the center of social life on campus. Student government is a student service association now, and it's struggling, and President Lee's son, interestingly enough, is president of that association right now, and he's trying to change it. But the social life really revolves around the wards. Whether that's by design or by default, I'm not sure. But you really get your socialization at BYU in your ward structure, not in any kind of campus format. Let me move on to faculty and students. It's my impression that the faculty from the early 80s to today are better and better every year. The faculty are more qualified, more interesting. And I would attribute this to the people that were hired after World War II. The older faculty are retiring, those that perhaps didn't keep up in their fields or weren't as well-trained to begin with. And they're being replaced by excellent, young, exciting scholars. And BYU to pick excellent people and recruit excellent people, and they're coming. And we had some unfortunate setbacks with the Farr and Knowlton cases, and I'll talk more about that later, although I'm not going to focus on that today. If you're interested in looking deeply at that issue, yesterday's session, I think it was number 223, Brian Waterman was there, another paper by Joanna Brooks was read, and other things. By that tape, that was excellent, talking about the current situation at BYU, the academic freedom. It's session 223. It was incredible. Anyway, back to the faculty. Because the faculty are younger, what I'm seeing happening at BYU is there's more student-faculty interaction. They're younger, they can relate to their students better, and the students can relate to them better. And with the added factor of the students being brighter, I think they're able to keep up with the faculty people better. So the point I want to make here is this increased student-faculty interaction is a very positive sign, probably the most positive thing I've seen in the last 10 years at BYU. I know my experience there working with different faculty and mentors has been a really wonderful experience for me. I really can't look at BYU as a whole as a positive educational experience, but there are selective faculty that were just really incredible. Let me move on to students and their relationship to administration and staff. I think it was Carl who said it's characterized by the phrase loss of confidence. I think that's really true. Hard for me to judge exactly what the administration's view of the students were in the early 80s, since I was really kind of apolitical and just kind of there like most freshmen. You know, you don't really know what you're doing. You just were offered a scholarship and you go, and your parents always expect you to go there, so you just go there. But what's happened over time, the ecclesiastical endorsement thing started, I think, late 80s, and that's where your bishop has to interview you and sign off this thing that you're worthy to attend another year at BYU. And at any time during the school year, if you violate that, they have the right to kick you out of school. And I know people who that's happened to. I've heard reports of spying. Friends of mine have been spied on, even as far as the MTC. Once they're in the MTC, they were being followed. This is an isolated case. But the student review ran reports of this, which, of course, was denied by Student Life. Although there have been changes to the Honor Code, there has been increased structure in the way that issues in the Honor Code are handled. There's like a student board, and they're very, just very structured. And I don't have any perspective on the 50s or how this ran in the 60s or whatever, but it seems to be in some ways more repressive, even though we can wear shorts now, we don't have to wear socks. And let me add an aside here. I think the long hair socks issue, frankly, it could have been, and this is a conspiracy theory, my friends and I, some of us think that that was a red herring to get students to write letters to the universe about no socks and hair so they wouldn't think about the bigger issues. Now that those are no longer issues, I mean, it's an interesting correlation that these bigger issues are emerging, and that's what students are thinking about. I'm sure there's other factors involved in that dynamic, but it's just kind of an interesting correlation. We're now required to have health insurance. We're still required to live in approved housing, but this is only for young single students. I guess they're the only ones that need to live with places that have locks or whatever they say. We're under increased pressure very recently to graduate in 4 years. I was noticing just this week that even the campus bulletin boards have signs posted on there that you cannot post anything on there unless it's been approved by the Student Service Association. It has to have the stamp. If not, it gets ripped off within hours because, you know, my friends and I, you know, I often try to advertise things that aren't approved. And you only can count on them being there for a few hours. In fact, the administration is so powerful that they've had a habit in the last few years of changing Mondays to Tuesdays and Fridays to Saturdays. And those of you who have been at VOU lately know what I mean. The difference between the Holland administration and the Lee administration is very interesting. In some ways, I think Holland was unwilling to face issues head on, and he either made somebody else take care of him, or he ignored certain things. I know he ignored student review completely. He would never see me or any of my friends in an open discussion about things, about student review, our status with the university, this kind of thing. Even from the beginning, when we wanted to get this started, I couldn't get an appointment with Holland. It was impossible. Lee seems to have a completely different style. He seems to go head on with things. I wrote an article for Sunstone in 1991 when I was still kind of optimistic about what was going on at BYU, and I wrote about what Lee was doing, his question and answer sessions, and I said, a refreshing change for BYU. This kind of open forum Holland would never touch, one university official told me, because Holland needed everything planned out. He squirmed just thinking about the uncertainties an open Q&A session would present. Yet this is Rex's genius, and he's put his quick-thinking mind on display 4 times this year, responding to students' questions and gripes publicly, cleverly glossing over sticky issues with humor, and in the end, endearing himself to most students. Of course, he also invites the press. This is a PR move, after all. Unlike the closed-door Holland administration, Lee at least gives the impression that he's willing to discuss campus issues without a safety net. Now, an interesting twist to this is, I think, Holland had been much more effective in articulating his vision for BYU, and because the Lee administration, there's so many tensions going on. I think that's why we have a lot of the tension today. There's a lot of infighting about where BYU wants to go. I'm going to move on now to students and their relationship to religion and the LDS Church. In the 1980s. I wasn't necessarily amazed with how faithful or how religious the students were. I guess I just expected it. And they were amazingly faithful and amazingly committed to the church. My sense today, though it's hard to tell, is the students are somewhat less religious, maybe not less spiritual, somewhat less religious. Evidence of this might be the ecclesiastical endorsement thing that they require. I'm sure BYU, my guess is BYU would never release the statistics on student church attendance, but their requiring this ecclesiastical endorsement thing seems to be a solution to some problem they're seeing in their numbers. Also, recently in the late 80s, they started closing all campus services during the devotional hour each week or every other week. So if somebody's speaking at a devotional, you can't go to the library, you can't go to the courier, you can't do anything but sit outside pretty much or go to the devotional. And that was pretty clear. That was in response to declining attendance at the devotionals. There's some other interesting adaptations that the church, I think, I don't know if it's conscious plan, but trends I've noticed. The bishops in the campus wards seem to be getting younger and younger, and they seem to have fewer ties with BYU. Generally, they'll draw on a young professional in an outlying city, which makes for some really actually fun and interesting bishops, and a little bit more rebellious, quite frankly, than bishops that I remember earlier on who were on the faculty. I've heard of cases, and know personally cases, of bishops who take the ecclesiastical endorsement thing very lightly and just sign them off wholesale, or bishops who absolutely refuse to collaborate with standards on revealing information about students and this kind of thing. And I've been vocal about that in their wards and say, I promise you I will not reveal anything to standards, blah, 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 blah. I find that a positive move. Right now, as I understand, BYU is in the process of making their wards much, much smaller. And I don't know what the effect of that will be. Let me move on to my last category, and that is students and their relationship with ideas. My impression is that students between the early 80s and early 90s arrived at BYU better prepared academically. I wrote this in 1991. Though most students still can't define politically correct PC issues, and when I say most, I mean maybe out of a class of 25, maybe one or two could define it. This was in 91, and of course it's changed big time since. For example, what was once viewed as a harmless scavenger hunt for women, a traditional activity for ASA sportsmen, quickly turned into a major discussion on the exploitation of women, as shown by letters in the campus paper's opinion page. And it goes on. And I also think students have become more and more willing to take a stand, to protest, to have a voice. I remember it in the mid-80s. I don't know what was going on, but going on with me personally. But I was very willing to start campus rallies and protests without permission and rallied friends around me. And it was more a consciousness-raising thing. And I think me personally, it was more of, I'm just curious how things will happen if I have this protest. We had protests on our consciousness-raising thing on Central America, some things on South Africa, some things on pollution. And it was really interesting how the administration responded. I remember specifically at one rally, I had recruited my roommate that very moment. I had signs like all ready to go at a moment's notice, but I recruited my roommate to come, and I had also called the press, and so they came, but I didn't step forward to take responsibility. So they somehow thought my roommate was responsible for this, who really knew very little about the issues. But he was quoted in the papers, and he was called in, and he received a letter from Standards. And it was very nicely worded, saying, next time you plan to do this, please fill out this form and get permission 24 hours in advance, on and on. Nowadays, activism is much more common. I wrote in 1991, activism at BYU has gradually increased in the last few years, with the goal for providing ample opportunity for students ready to exercise their rights. Transferring their energies from the ever more popular BYU ecology movement, a small but determined group orchestrated what the militant claims was the largest anti-war movement on any campus. Organizers of BYU's peace movement were quick to stake out a table in the Wilkinson Center step-down lounge, a major campus crossroad, for the duration of the war, where they distributed literature and represented minority opinion. Supporters told me they were skipping classes to maintain a presence there throughout the day. One even dropped out of school. Eventually, another group set up a Support the Troops booth across the lounge. And this was really an interesting time to be at BYU, it seemed. And this was the context I wrote this Sunstone article where I was quite optimistic. I thought, wow, there's some great discussion, some great pluralism going on here, despite some hints of infringement of academic freedom. Well, that's kind of all the good news. Let me get to the bad news about ideas. Quite frankly, most students, the vast majority of students, still see BYU as a place to go to get a degree, a little piece of paper, and job skills, and to get a spouse. Too few are truly interested in becoming educated, and I think this is evidenced by student reaction when a class is canceled. I mean, they're so happy, and I'm like, wait a minute, you paid for this. Let me do a final section that I call BYU's trajectory, and I use trajectory in kind of a deliberate sense. After the Seventh East Press affair quieted down in the early 80s and BYU won the national championship in 1984, I believe BYU entered what we might look back and call the golden age of BYU. Never before and never again would BYU enjoy the same combination of national prestige and campus tranquility. Of course, Student Review started in 1986, which is kind of a constant thorn in BYU's side, but I still think that was part of the golden age. Later in the 80s, the campus community became more willing to address more serious issues. Early on at the review, it was policy. We would not talk about, we'd be very careful with issues of feminism, and we would not talk about issues of homosexuality and be very careful with evolution, because we knew the campus community would not support that. We'd lose advertisers and go under. However, in the late 80s, the Student Review treated that very openly, and the campus community responded really quite well, I thought. When Lee arrived, I felt it signaled we were at a crossroads with BYU. I really believe that President Holland had increased our national stature and also the endowment of the university, that BYU was at a place where it could choose two paths. One path I'll call the university tradition or the Notre Dame path. The other path is the Polytechnic Trade School path or the Oral Roberts path. And I think BYU has been vacillating at this crossroads until just this spring, and I'll talk about that just briefly. I believe we could have taken the path to be a university in the true sense of the university tradition, with a classical liberal education focusing on free inquiry, critical thinking, ontology, epistemology, aesthetics, those kinds of issues, because the students were brighter, we had better faculty, and we had better resources. We were really at a point where things could go very well for us. Quite frankly, I think BYU has chosen the other path. I believe that BYU is, it should be changed. It was BYUA, BYA, BYU. Now it should be BYP, BYU Polytechnic. I think we're on the path that's headed to a vocational school with a religious seminary attached. If you look at the programs that are receiving funding, that are favored, that are not coming under fire, it's the very practical, career-oriented things like business, law, nursing, engineering, teaching. These kinds of things. I think the recent decision on the Farr and Knowlton cases are just kind of a public symbol of the decision that the Board of Trustees has taken, the path that they're intending to take. Let me make a little aside here. I don't think BYU is alone in taking this more practical path. I think it's an issue in general in universities today where they're training their students to be good career people and not necessarily critical thinkers. However, BYU differs in its level of tolerance for people who do want to go to the university and read all sorts of texts and discuss all sorts of ideas. I personally, and this is kind of a pessimistic view, I don't think BYU will turn back on this decision. I can't really condemn the board for making this decision. In some ways, I think it's their prerogative. However, I just wish the board or the administrators or whoever's doing the PR for BYU or the advertising would advertise the school a little more honestly and truthfully and admit that coming to BYU is not equivalent to going to some other university. It's not a university plus something extra. It's becoming a different beast altogether, I believe. The two most critical issues facing BYU right now are, one, the enrollment ceiling, and two, the academic freedom issue. And I think each of those issues alienates a very important sector of the LDS population. Probably all of us know somebody who was denied admission to BYU, probably a bright student, but not quite bright enough to make it to BYU. Imagine how that student and their faithful, tithe-paying parents feel about their son or daughter not being able to go to BYU. That's I think, going to be a bigger and bigger issue. The other one is the academic freedom issue. Like I said, most students are oblivious to these problems. However, I think only the most callous students can ignore the growing malaise in and around BYU. The Farr and Knowlton cases are not the causes of this malaise, but tangible evidence of what has been going on, at least for the last little while. And yes, I believe the golden era of the 80s is gone. The dissatisfaction of the 90s is spreading across campus, and unfortunately, I don't see things getting better at BYU for a long time.
We'd like to thank the panelists for sharing their memories and thoughts and observations and predictions about BYU. It looks like we have about 15 minutes left in this session for questions and answers. If you have a question, please state it clearly. I'll then repeat it if need be and pass the microphone to whichever panelist you'd like to question. Are there any questions? The question was, what effect will recent events at BYU have on its accreditation, which is coming up in, I guess there's a self-study that's done first, and is that in 94, and then the Northwest Association shows up a year later, something like that.
I haven't consulted the birds flying to the right or to the left or the entrails of any dean. But it's personally, I think that BYU's accreditation is in jeopardy. It would depend on the reviewing committee. It would depend on what kind of audit would come out of that kind of institutional examination. It would depend, for example, on knowing whether faculty members in the religious studies division are held to the same publication standards as people in other divisions, and I have no idea how that kind of audit would come out. But if it appeared that academic freedom in a genuine sense, a de facto sense, had largely disappeared, I think the accreditation would very likely be in danger.
Anybody else on the panel interested? I'm going to be more pessimistic than Carl was on that. I suspect that the accreditation, the reaccreditation in a couple of years, the recent events at BYU will probably not have any significant impact on BYU's reaccreditation. That the primary body responsible for securing some kind of reaction to what's going on at BYU is going to be the faculty. And if the faculty, by and large, seem fairly complacent, which seems to be the case, except in a handful of instances, then the accrediting committee won't have anything really to respond to. So it's going to be up to the faculty to be honest about their own reactions, provided that they have any.
Yes. I could comment there briefly, if I may. I was on the accrediting committee of the NARM Central Association when I was at Purdue University. And I was at Purdue University from 1947 through 76, following my stint at Brigham Young University. I graduated at Brigham Young in 35 and was on the faculty from 35 through 47. So I was not on the accrediting association that pertains to this area, but I know something about the process. It would be my humble opinion that if the attempt to define academic freedom in the terms as presently stated holds, and rather than the traditional definition of academic freedom for the individual, for the professor, for the student, if the present definition holds, there would be little or no chance of an accrediting team reaccrediting BYU. That's only an opinion based upon an experience, a 10-year experience with another accrediting association.
I'm not sure if we'll reach that far. Did you have a question?
Well, I would just like to suggest that there's one other primary body that may have and that may be those of us parents. I have a 17-year-old senior in high school who's a student body president, 4-point student, a National Merit Scholar, and he will not go to BYU. And I think that that will have an impact. I'm sixth-generation Mormon. We have BYU graduates all the way back. And I think under the current circumstances, I don't want the next generation to be a BYU graduate.
I have kind of a related question there. I'm contemplating getting a master's degree from BYU, and that's been my plan. But I don't like the direction that Brigham Young University is taking, and I don't wish to support it. And, so, and I'm worried that my degree, if I choose to go there, would be worthless. However, it would be a shame for all the dissenters just to leave and let the administration have its way with the docile non-dissenter. What does the panel feel is the best approach, to go or not to go?
The question is, for someone who's contemplating going to BYU, either as an undergraduate or a graduate, what should they do? Should they go or not?
I'm not sure what I'm going to say. That's a really tough issue. I don't regret doing my master's at BYU because I worked with excellent faculty. I do regret doing my undergraduate there, however. I mean, I did some great stuff and whatever, but I probably would have been better served elsewhere. To go or not go, it would really depend on the faculty you'll be working with. And I think a lot of us this year, this spring, who are accepted into graduate programs, PhD programs for this fall, like I was, and into good universities, when this whole thing blew up and became national, we were just thinking our lucky stars. It didn't happen before they evaluated our applications. I don't know how that's going to affect the way other graduate schools look at BYU, but it may have an effect, and you may not get into the PhD program you want if you have a degree from BYU. I don't know. But in terms of what I learned in my master's program, it was excellent, and I don't regret that. But it was the specific faculty I worked with.
One complicating factor in this question of whether to go to BYU or not go to BYU is what university would a person choose as an alternative? Because if we look at the national scene, higher education generally, I think, has fallen on evil days. And it's not altogether certain that one would get a better education at a more prestigious university, given the present climate. There are many institutions that I think have been stopped educationally dead in the water. They're kind of paralyzed while they fight out the culture wars. And in choosing university, one has to consider all of those kinds of factors.
I'd be interested in Kate's response to that. I don't mean to put her on the spot, but...
I suppose... After the Farr Knowlton debate, I heard that there were a couple of women, former graduates, who went, at least one anyway, who personally went into the president of the university's office and slammed her diploma down on the secretary's desk and said, "I have no use for this." I sort of felt like doing the same thing and was sorry someone had beat me to it. No one can speak for you, of course, and yet, so you can either flee or you can stay and perhaps try to improve the atmosphere in some small way in your circle. And at one point, I suppose the best option is to jump ship, but in the meantime, maybe you should try to bail out the water. And it's up to you to decide at what point you think, or how you can affect it, or at what point the university itself is, or where it's going.
Yes.
In fact, my husband said, "Just be careful," and I said, "At this point, I really don't care." I am a BYU graduate, 1977, was an honor student, did the whole thing, and it is very hard for me to discourage my children from going to my own alumni because I am disgusted and appalled with what I see becoming nothing more than a religious academy that could have been an outstanding educational opportunity for thousands of children and young adults to be exposed to ideas they may never have had another chance to be exposed to, and to people from all over the world that have different cultures than our quote-unquote white, pure culture that's all we see. around us. I had the experience to go to Washington, D.C., where I saw black people, you know, and they were real live people, and they functioned, and it took me back, because I had always been raised with a very open mind, but to actually have the opportunity to assimilate in a different culture. I was so appalled that I wrote a letter to the editors of our local papers about what was happening down there, hoping that it would make an impact and spur others to do likewise. I maybe saw one other letter to the editor on the same issue. As I am in graduate school myself now at a different university, and as I expressed this concern with fellow students, they all laughed at me and said, well, you know what you get when you go down there. And I was left with the idea that it was I who was laboring under the misconception that BYU was ever a university. And it appears that so many others out there have already accepted the fact that it is simply a religious academy and that it never was a university. And that's what I find extremely sad.
I was impressed with what Carl Sandburg said. I grew up in Salt Lake, and I always swore I'd never go there. And I went there after a mission. Went on to graduate school at Indiana University, University of Toronto, in philosophy and religious studies. Taught as a visiting professor at BYU in 88 and 89, and again in summer of 91. And I think you should still send your kids there. I teach at a regional state university in North Carolina. The students are more passionate at BYU about truth than they are at most other places. What you said is very true. Students at most other schools I've been to, even in philosophy, were almost more concerned at one-upmanship, and these were great places. I love the schools I went to. Were more concerned about one-upmanship, or they were more concerned about, at the school I teach now, about, you know, just getting through and getting a job, what you call the polytechnic sense, you know, and that's the kind of place I teach at. But even at finer, at better schools, I find it that way. When I was at BYU as a visiting professor, you sit in the, albeit I was in the philosophy department, students in philosophy are strange, but I'd sit in the philosophy reading room, and almost inevitably four or five kids would come in, and they'd want to talk about philosophy, and they'd want to talk about truth in relation to religion. It's a wonderful place. I mean, I haven't been there lately, you know, in the last couple of years. I know there are problems there, but it's still a wonderful place, you know, and you don't cut and run. I mean, you got to save it. I mean, if it's, the whole church is worth saving. I mean, you know, so is BYU.
I'm sorry, Gary. I'm on the faculty at BYU, and I'm concerned about what we're hearing here today. Recently, I was in Mexico, and on the way back, it was early in the morning, and it was black, and the mists were all about. And we were talking about these things, my wife and I, and it seemed like it was a vision opening before our eyes. President Kimball said Brigham Young University would become a great mountain of learning. And I think even if it dies, it will be resurrected, because that prophecy will come to pass. I would encourage people to come to BYU. I cannot encourage you that you will not have pain there, and some people will justifiably burn out of activism. We have to share the role here. But it should be known that a large portion of the faculty, even in those technical areas, consider themselves feminists. My dean considers himself a feminist and is anxious to point out that as long as he's dean, no one is going to have any trouble at all speaking at Sunstone or participating in any way. There are problems, it's true, and I can't say that we just, you know, shouldn't ignore those things. One of the things I think parents should do is something that's suggested by Linda Jones, which is to form a committee to find out which bishops are good bishops and which stakes are good stakes, because there are killer bishops and there are killer stake presidents. And we can independently organize ourselves in a way that students can have the kind of experience in that part of their life that they need. We have to understand that there are other things happening in the faculty that conspire to make some of the problems we have. A lot of it is fear. There is a lot of fear, and we have to remember Moroni's words, or Mormon's words in Moroni, that the answer to fear is perfect love. And then if we pray the Father in the name of Christ, we can receive that love. But we have to do that as a group, as individuals. And remember that in the end, truth will prevail. In these times, also, we need to understand that things have changed on the faculty. And some of the faculty, well, we may act in ways that conspires with the oppressors. What do I mean by that? Well, they've recently changed the way in which three-year reviews have been done. And you should know that we are allowed in our departments, in our colleges, to put a strong push. The university is trying to create, by pure force, something which doesn't exist. They're trying to set a hurdle at 7 foot when the people who are evaluating the hurdle only went through it over at 16 inches. No, this is true. But they allow you to give an assist. So if your college and your department give you a strong assist, you will fly over the bar at 7 foot. But the trouble is that some of our brethren and sisters who are controversial are not getting that assist. Therefore, those of us in other departments in the university need to do what we can to assist them over the bar, or the system has to be changed again to reflect it. But we can't suggest that every decision came down from the Board of Trustees when the faculty themselves, anticipating counsel, collaborated in it. One of my friends suggested, in fact, that the experiences of the murder of Thomas A. Becket may be appropriate here. If somebody in authority says loud enough, "Would somebody rid me of this priest?" there may be some people only too glad to cooperate, and never can a decision be found that will say directly, "He ordered it done." The other, I've taken enough time now, but I think that I'd like to encourage people to help us in helping BYU realize its destiny and not have to be raised from the dead to do it. Thank you.
I'd just like to add to what David said. My wife and I have had 4 children. Each of them took out, all of them took out their youthful rebellion by running away to BYU. Each of them got a superior education. People will continue to get superior educations at BYU, but they have to do it in the same way that they get it at any other institution, which is by taking charge of their education. And I simply like to endorse what David said and reiterate what I said in my remarks, that there are too many energies which are loose on the campus and in the church and in the nation for them to be turned back. So the future, I think, is much more open than it sometimes appears.
We have time for just one more comment or question.
BYU class of 1952. But it's only fair to say that I've had 32 years as a professor at the University of Utah. I appreciate very much the advice you gave because I believe that is true of every university. There are no guaranteed good ways to get educated. I want to remind everyone who is either a graduate or a tithe-paying LDS, that they are indeed the constituency of BYU. You are creating it. It is your school. And your money is being used to do whatever they do down there. And as stockholders, I think that you have rights to...